Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, Anfidela. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener calling number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, Audrey, for that introduction and getting us all hooked up and wired into the show. And Audrey, do you know how long you've been doing this? Yes, November 1st, it will be 4 years. 4 years times 52 weeks in a year. How many radio shows is that? Unbelievable. And nobody's run us off the air yet. How about that? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Mike, please, will you turn off your microphone when you're drinking coffee? Thank you very much. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that usual trip he takes us across the United States where he visits 90 cities and states. And, Johnny, I got a little news here for you. You might feel safer. One of our news stories tonight has to do with the Google car and technology that will drive itself. In other words, you don't have to do a thing. And they've drove thousands of miles in a little hopped-up Prius. And Google says pretty soon that this technology, it already can read faster, better than we can in terms of what's needed for road reactions and safety measures, and we'll see how long it takes us to go down and buy a car with Google technology where we don't even have to drive. Little frightening, I think. Emily, thank you very much for joining us also. And Mike, thank you very much for turning off your microphone while you're drinking your coffee. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is what it always is. We try to discuss news, issues, events, and developments in this seemingly difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Some people would say criminal justice may not be as complicated as we make it, but we do that with everything, don't we, in America? Our show is dedicated to the tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. What we try to do here is look inside criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professionals as they do their work. Tonight will be a little different kind of show. I'll talk to you about it in just a moment. But Blog Talk Radio is a leading-edge technology. Alan Levy is the CEO. The CEO of BTR. You can see him right on the front page. If you go to blogtalkradio.com, click on there, hear him talk about the genius medium that he created here 4 years ago. We were with him just about as soon as he got up. And what is possible here is any person in the interest group in the organization. It can range from dart playing to horseshoe playing to astronomy to whatever. You can have your own radio show, and you can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost a thing. Think of this. Worldwide broadcasting doesn't cost a thing. We know occasionally some people listen to us actually in Europe, so it's possible. Our shows are archived almost immediately, all shows. Anybody would have a radio show, and they can be downloaded and played in MP3 format, or you can go right to the show website itself and get archived shows. So it's a fantastic medium, and we hope people listen and join, and I think a couple have actually started shows based on our recommendation. Well, tonight our show is going to be a little bit different. And this show could be interesting just from the standpoint of a standard public entertainment. It can get a little anthropological in its discussion tonight, and it can be a little bit philosophical. But we're going to look at a professor, author Huante Wong, and he's a professor of English at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has also taught at Harvard before. And he's going to talk about his book, Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. And I know there are people listening in the audience who have never heard of Charlie Chan. But if you went to the movies a number of decades ago, you would see Charlie Chan movies. And you can't believe how many Charlie Chan movies. 8 different novels about Charlie Chan, and it's interesting how the character evolved over time, and it's really based on a real-life detective in Hawaii, who right after, I think, 1898, something like that, Hawaii became a U.S. possession. They formed a police force, of course, and this guy was a detective, and he is the source of the Charlie Chan character, but he evolved over time. Kind of an interesting discussion. Those of you who are writers or thinking about being writers, you'll hear Professor Wong actually talk about how he had writer's block for 2 years when he came to California to write, do some writing, and then finally he broke out of that and went on to talk about this very interesting type of book. Okay. So I think you'll like that. You're listening on your computer. You can call in by phone if you want to during the news segment, and that's at 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983 if you want to comment on some of our news stories tonight. We probably won't have as many as usual tonight, but we've got some interesting ones, I think. You know, criminal justice is loaded with odd news, and some of it serious and some of it not so serious. Emily, would you close the door? That cat's back in here again. Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but let's go ahead. But the number is 347-996-5983. And if you're a new listener to the show, what we'll find out is that you are able to listen to Audrey talk about a blonde joke. She is from London, England. She's a collector of blonde jokes. She has thousands of them stored in trunks in her home. And tonight she's going to let us listen to one of her blonde jokes. And I think this one's a little bit different tonight, isn't it, Audrey? From what you were telling me, I think it is. Let's see if the audience can pick that up. It's about two blondes, a man and a woman, a married couple. Okay, Audrey, let's hear it.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is actually one that involves a blonde married couple and their adoption of a baby. I think our listeners will really enjoy this one. Here it is. Dustin and Jane, a married couple who are both blondes, were delighted when finally their long wait to adopt a baby had come to an end. The adoption center called and told them they had a wonderful Russian baby boy, and the couple took him without hesitation. On the way home from the adoption center, they stopped by the local college so they each could enroll in evening classes. After they filled out the enrollment forms, the registration officer inquired, "Whatever possessed you to study Russian?" The couple said proudly, "We just adopted a Russian baby, and in a year or so he'll start to talk. We just want to be able to understand him."
All right. Thank you very much, Audrey. That's a good one. We want to be able to understand him. He'll be speaking Russian, that's for sure. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, we'd like to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms public service announcement that's directed toward the street criminals. And we can't even imagine how much good this has done in the 3 or 4 years we've been doing and playing their public service announcement. I'm sure that criminals will hear this tonight and give up their firearms and get down and turn them into the police department. Even without a buyback type of program, they could get a Best Buy card for music or whatever, but they're going to do it. So, Ohio Coalition, go ahead with your very fine public service announcement.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is, Ohio Coalition, a deadly idea, and we thank you very much. I have thought that you could sort of tune up your... I'm going to write them and ask them if they can sort of tune up their firearm a little bit and make it a little more demonstrable, something a little more meaningful and perhaps shocking to the public, and therefore the criminals may also see it also. Something on the order of this. Something on the order of machine gun. I think that would probably work pretty well, too. So. But thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. We really appreciate what you're doing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of planet sustainability, and the planet keeps getting warmer. I'm sweating right now. It keeps getting warmer, and things keep getting destroyed minute by minute on the planet. And what I thought we'd do, as we always do, is we'll have a green tip, and we're always drawing those tips from ESMA. Floyd, that's ESME, in case you haven't picked up that book yet. I certainly have. I've been plugging this book for over a year. It's 1,001 ways, little ways, to save the planet. This one tonight I'm going to read. I honestly don't know if I can do this one. Now, the ones about using your bath water more than once, I suppose. But let's try this one out. Mike, you said it's possible. I mean, it works. Here we go. And this one is number 273 in the book 1001, Little Ways to Save the Planet. And this one has to do with limiting your toilet flushes. Think about whether it's really necessary to flush the toilet every time you visit the toilet. Make a rule of thumb only to flush every other time you use the toilet. And I suppose, ladies and gentlemen, you become more accustomed to doing this, that perhaps you can get it down to one out of every three or one out of every four times. But that's tip number 273 in the book. Let's send some delegates out to do that. Mike, would you try that this next week and see how it works out? And think of the water that you're saving and all kinds of other things. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. And let's start off with the criminal justice bazaar, if I can say it. We now have a Philadelphia suburb that wants to pass a law. It's probably going to happen. Suburban Philadelphia Township is considering whether to fine people who don't lock their car doors. The commissioners in this community, it's Upper Moreland Township, are debating an ordinance that will require people to lock their car doors when parked in public areas or face a citation and a fine of $25. The police chief, Chief Nestle, says that since 2008, three-fourths or more of each year's reported thefts in the township are from cars left unlocked. I suppose we could say that maybe the muggings and the thefts are also from people who are unarmed, right? Maybe we can find them. No, he doesn't want to do that. But the Bucks County Courier-Times reports that under the proposal, police would do spot checks on cars in neighborhoods having problems with thefts from cars. What do you think of that? Mike, what do you think of that one? I don't like it either. I think that's a little, you know, if I want my car unlocked, you know, it's a hot sunny day or something like that, and I don't want to lock my car up, have the windows up and make it boiling by the time I get back to the car, it's my business. And particularly if I don't have anything in it to steal. I suppose people come steal the seats or whatever, but that's not likely. But is that a little bit too much in terms of what we're thinking about here? Anyway, it's an interesting idea. How about this one? What do you think about this? Now, I'm probably going to get some criticism about this from some folks. Let's see if I can find this article about... Come on, Evernote, move. It's stuck. I use Evernote as a clipping service for these kind of things. Yes, here we go. This is already going on. This is Farmingville, New York. You've heard of Megan's Law, certainly, folks. They're designed to keep sex offenders from striking again. Now there's going to be a law in Farmingville. There is a law created in the hope of preventing animal abusers from inflicting more cruelty or moving on to human beings. Now, I'll comment in just a moment, but Suffolk County on the eastern half of Long Island moved to create the nation's first animal abuse registry this week, requiring people convicted of cruelty to animals to register or face jail time and fines. So like a sex offender registry, we're going to have an animal abuser registry. Kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? What do you think of that idea? We know that there's a very strong correlation between animal abuse and domestic violence, and Suffolk County legislator John Cooper, I wonder how strong that correlation is. John Cooper, the bill's sponsor, almost every serial killer starts out by torturing animals. I got to check into that. I'm not so sure. So in a strange sense, we could end up protecting the lives of people. The online list will be open to the public so that pet owners or the merely curious can find out whether someone living near them is on the animal abuser watch list. Some animal abusers have been known to steal their neighbor's pets. Cooper's also pushing legislation that would bar anyone on the registry from buying or adopting a pet from a shelter. So there goes rehabilitation, I guess. Pet shop or breeder. The law was prompted by a number of animal abuse cases in recent months, including a Selden woman, I suppose in that township up there. She was accused of forcing her children to watch her torture and kill kittens and dozens of dogs, then burying the pets in their backyards. The animal welfare activists think this is a great idea. This is in the suburban New York City county of 1.5 million people. This will inspire governments nationwide to come up with an animal abuser registry. Really kind of interesting. A guy who's caught carrying his little Yorkshire Terrier into someplace, a pet store last week, and he applauded the legislation. He says it's very, very important. If you don't love an animal, you should not have an animal. An animal is part of your family. Like your children, they should never be neglected or abused. Well, most people would certainly agree with that. But what do you think? Is that a bit of a stretch? A stretch to have that? And of course, everybody that they interviewed for the article is walking a dog, and they agree with it. But that is something, isn't it? I mean, we're going to have an animal abuse registry. That is something. Here's another interesting little story. This college student finds out that he was being secretly monitored by the FBI when he found a GPS tracking device hidden in his car. According to Wired magazine, I love Wired, if you haven't ever looked at it online, or it's a beautiful magazine to hold in your hand, which reported that FBI agents and police officers showed up at his apartment to reclaim this GPS device after a friend of his posted photos of it online. How did the FBI know about it online? Interesting. The student, Yasir Afifi, is a 20-year-old U.S.-born citizen who's majoring in business marketing at Mission College in the Bay Area. Mr. Afifi, whose late father was Egyptian-born, a U.S. citizen who led a local community association, told Wired.com that he's on a federal watch list at airports and was asked by FBI agents about travel to Yemen and overseas training that he went to. The agents knew about his new job and which restaurants he and his girlfriend prefer. Kind of interesting, isn't it? So the GPS kind of tracks you around, and they make it's probably some of those, Top Secret America, those 856,000 with Top Secret clearances are following this guy around in terms of all the places that he goes to eat and perhaps what he eats and all sorts of things. You know, there's a indescript or nondescript almost terrorist alert kind of out now. I saw that on the evening news that there's some kind of alert up, but then they don't know where it is and they don't know who it's about, but they say there's evidence to show that the alert ought to go up, but they don't know much more about that. Kind of hard to figure out, isn't it? All right, let's finish with the Google Drive here. Anyone that's been driving around Highway 1 in San Francisco, they may have seen this little Toyota Prius. Well, it's not so little, actually, with a curious funnel-like cylinder on the top. And this is the Google Car Project, and they've been working in secret in plain view. How can you be both? In secret and in plain view on vehicles that can drive themselves using artificial intelligence. Emily, why don't you try that first? I don't know if I want to put myself in the hands of Google entirely. I'm probably already in their hands considerably right now, but it's interesting that they want to do this. When someone behind the wheel, to take control if something goes awry, and a technician in the back seat to monitor the navigation, they have 7 test cars that have driven 1,000 miles without any human intervention, and more than 140 miles with only occasional human control. They've even gone down Lombard Street in San Francisco. That's like one of the steepest, curviest streets in America, right? The only accidents the engineers had was when one Google car was rear-ended while stopped at a traffic light. I guess they can't much prevent that. I think it makes the car fly or something, but isn't that interesting? These autonomous cars are years from mass production, they're saying, but it's close. What doesn't Google do for us? I mean, just incredible. But that'd be good police cars. Wouldn't it? Police chases, they could chase and not hurt anybody and not have wrecks and that type of thing. So anyway, very interesting idea. What else have I got here? Let's keep that one. Let's save that one to another time. All right, what we're going to do now is shift to our presenter for this evening. And he's going to be talking about Charlie Chan, and most people have some idea about Charlie Chan. Lots of radio shows, 8 novels, lots of movies. It's interesting that the person that played Charlie Chan the most successful one was not Oriental. And you'll hear the author talk about that tonight. So here we go with the discussion of Charlie Chan and the book, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective, and his Rendezvous with American History. The author is Yun-Pei Huang from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Don't leave, we're getting close. While we're waiting, you can go to archive.org and hear a lot of Charlie Chan shows. So don't do it now, but later.
The English professor's latest book looks at a Hawaiian detective who is the basis for the fictional novel and movie character Charlie Chan. D.G. Wilf Books in La Jolla, California hosts this hour-long talk.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Dennis. And we really want to thank DigiWales, the great bookstore here, for hosting this event. Secondly, I want to say I'm really happy to be back in California. Some of you may know that I'm spending the year visiting Cornell University. As beautiful as Ithaca fall is, you know, I really miss California. I remember when I first moved to Santa Barbara 7 years ago from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was sitting on the beach every day, and I was really bored. I thought I was, you know, coming to California to be a writer on the beach, but I ended up having a writer's block for 2 years. Slowly but surely, the land of Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald grew on me. And when I began to look at the landscape, you know, through the lens of this master detective writer, even Orange Groves, you know, acquired some sort of kind of Hogwarts lingo that in which I feel strangely at home. But tonight I'm going to talk about another master detective, an unusual one for that matter. Through him, I don't just see California, I see America. So my plan is I'm going to read a very short excerpt for about like 5 minutes, and then I'm going to talk for anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes, and then before, you know, returning to reading another very short, you know, excerpt. There should be enough time for Q&A. So the piece I'm going to read first takes us back over 100 years in history. On a balmy July night in 1904, a wiry waif of a man sauntered alone through the dim alleys of Honolulu's Chinatown. A mere 5 feet tall, with intense shoulders and a ramrod straight back, the man was wearing a Canton crepe blouse, threadbare trousers, and a Panama hat. A pair of dark glasses obscured the scar above his eye. His upper lip, blackened by burnt cork, gave the impression that he needed a shave. From a distance, he was unmistakably Chinese, barely distinguishable as he walked among the shuffling throng of his countrymen. The hot, southerly corner weather, which had piled the breakers high along the coast and sapped the spirit out of every living being, had departed the island by sundown. A gentle trade wind blowing in from the northeast had brought renewed energy to the city. A local boy was plucking soft tunes on his ukulele, perhaps down on the moonlit beach not far below the street, fringed with coconut palms and licked by the lazy surf. When the serenade paused, a cock miner gave out a clear throated cry, ruffling its plumage beneath the canopy of a perfumed night. Under the sickle moon, the Chinaman reached the corner of Smith Street in the heart of Chinatown. He slowed his pace on the darkened street, where shops and the restaurants displayed cardboard signs scrawled in his native language. They had shut their doors much earlier, except one nondescript building where he saw a glint of light escaping through an upstairs window. A thin snarl flickered at the corners of his mouth. He drew a deep breath. The night air was a strange melange of odors that lingered from the oil walks and the salty tang of the Pacific wind. Through the unlit front gate, he stepped cautiously inside the building and passed by the doorman undetected. He did the same at the next 3 doors, each guarded by someone, each leading him deeper into what seemed like a maze of Chinese boxes. Climbing up the rickety stairs to the second floor, he turned and faced a room packed with gamblers, all Chinese, humming over games of fantan, haikao, craps, and the mahjong. The air was a mix of smut and smoke, the den ringing with curses, jeers, and the sound of clicking dice in the mahjong piles. He observed the ballyhoo through his dark lenses. Someone at the mahjong table looked up and immediately recognized the face of the infamous cop whose name elicited shudders from the spines of Honolulu criminals. Title. Before the Cantonese cry for cop dropped to the ground, a 5-foot bullwhip had uncoiled like hissing rattlesnake from the detective's waist. One crisp snap of the whip and the entire room froze like a gambling hall diorama under glass. Only clouds of cigarette smoke still wavered, the afterthoughts of exploded firecrackers, not sure where to settle in the deafening silence. Many there had already heard of, and some had even tasted, the might of this unusual weapon wielded by the former rough-riding Pagnolo. Resisting arrest would be futile, even though they knew he had, as usual, brought no backup. His wit had spoken louder than any law or gun. Telling them the jig was up, the Chinaman, known to the locals as Connor Poong, lined up the gamblers, 40 in all, and marched them out of the room and down to the police station on Bethel Street. Not a single shot was fired. Connor Poong's real name was Chang Apana. An officer of the Honolulu Police Department, he will later acquire a more fascinating moniker, Charlie Chan. His colorful exploits, like the bravado on this July night, would one day draw the attention of mainland novelist Earl Desiggers. From 1925 onward, a total of 6 novels and a 47 films, in addition to radio programs, newspaper comics, and countless full fortune cookie witticisms, would make Charlie Chan, upon a fictional double, one of the most enduring cultural icons of 20th century America. As some of you may know, some of you especially who have read the book or either the reviews out there, will know that in this book, I'm trying to tie up several loose strands, each of which is a story. As Charlie Chan would say, truth, like football, receives many kicks before reaching goal. So in order to solve this, Charlie Chan mystery, I need to give this football truth several kicks. With each kick, hopefully gaining me kind of different yardage, if not mileage. The first kick is, of course, the story of Chang Apana, the real Charlie Chang, this rough and tumble Hawaiian cowboy. Just to tell his story very briefly, he was born in Hawaii around 1871. His father was their coolie laborer, from Canton, who came to work on sugarcane plantations. At the age of 3, Apana went to China with his parents. He grew up in the same district as actually Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the founding father of the Republic of China, who also actually came of age later on in Honolulu. They actually overlap, Apana and Sun Yat-sen. Anyway, at the age of 10, Apana came back to Hawaii with his uncle. He became a pañuelo, that's the Hawaiian word for cowboy, and worked at ranches. He joined the police force in 1898, just when Hawaii was annexed by the United States. He almost immediately became, a local legend, because as a police officer, he will walk the most dangerous beats in Chinatown, carrying a bullwhip that, he had made himself. He was a master of disguise. He was actually the first undercover cop for that department. He could single-handedly, as I, read in the prologue, could single-handedly arrest 40 people without firing a shot. So, as an illiterate man, the son of a coolie laborer, if we could use the parlance of the 19th century, he was really a man, who would have stood no Chinaman's chance, for that matter. And yet, he made a name for himself, and became the inspiration for the fictional Charlie Chan. The second kick, or the second story I'm trying to tell in the book, is about Earl Desiggers. And that's another, to me, coming from China, that's another amazing American story. This, young Buckeye from Ohio with no family connection, and yet, he managed to get into Harvard and became a best-selling author. Biggers was born in Warren, Ohio, in 1884, and his parents actually had to borrow money to send him to Harvard. And he did pretty well. He joined the, Lampoon, Signia Club, and Advocate, and all these societies. And after his graduation, he went to Harvard in 1903. His last year actually overlapped with G.S. Eliot. Anyway, after he graduated from Harvard, his first job was a night police, reporter for a Cleveland Plain Dealer, a newspaper in Cleveland. He was almost immediately fired because the editor soon found out that he was a much better storyteller than a journalist. So, especially when the matter is police matter, when you made up stories, you know. But in a strange way, we really have to thank, you know, Cleveland Plain Dealer for upholding such high standards of journalism. You know, otherwise, you know, had bigger, you know, kept his job, that may have not have been Charlie Chang at all, for that matter. So as Charlie Chang would say, you know, door of opportunity swing both ways, you know, and this is America. Anyway, so a bigger turn to the writing of mystery novels after, you know, he lost that job. His very first important book was the mystery novel, Seven Keys to Budapest, published in 1913. As a writer, Biggert had a thing for keys, you know, for the title. First one is Seven Keys to Budapest, the first Charlie Chang novel, The House Without a Key, and later on another Charlie Chang novel, Keeper of the Key, again. The success of Seven Keys to Budapest propelled him into national limelight, but he was soon overworked, so he had to take a vacation in Hawaii. And it was on the beach of, you know, Waikiki, as the story goes, that he first came up with the idea of a Charlie Chang novel. But to be honest, you know, the first Charlie Chang novel with The House Without a Key was not really strictly a Charlie Chang novel, because, you know, the detective does not appear until about one-third into the book. And he really started out as a minor character, like the third man, the Chinaman. But obviously his charm was irresistible. And as soon as the book was published, readers clamored for more Charlie Chang books in which the character, you know, the detective would be a central character. Therefore, the Chang dynasty, you know, began in 1925. And this is the third story I want to tell in the book. It's really about the making of Charlie Chang, the iconic Chinaman. We could say the timing of Charlie Chang's birth could not have been any better or worse, depending how you look at it. Because in 1924, the year before then, the United States had just passed the infamous Johnson-Reed Act, the anti-immigration bill, basically. The bill was targeting the Irish, Southern Europeans like Italians, or Eastern Europeans, and all Asians. So it was a turning point in American culture when the country literally closed its door to the so-called foreigners. And there you go, there's one lovely, funny, wisecracking foreigner, you know, stumbling on stage. The question is, why is that? You know, we should understand, despite the fact the 20s was probably one of the most xenophobic eras, you know, in American history. Some people may argue today it is actually another one. Despite that, America always had this long-lasting love or craze, you know, for the Orient or for Asia. So you can just recall, for instance, people like, you know, Ernest Fenollosa, even Henry Adams or John Lafarge or Lafcadio Hearn, who went to Japan and China and brought back, you know, art and literature, you know, and everything, you know, from the Orient. So Orientalism was, you know, in the air. So we have to acknowledge that. And therefore, you know, Charlie Chang, you know, was born in this very strange period when, you know, xenophobia and xenophilia, you know, were tied together like Siamese twins in many ways. And Hollywood, which can never forget Hollywood, or have enough of it, which had just begun to grab the lion's share of American popular imagination, very soon, you know, jumped on what I would call, you know, the Charlie Chang bandwagon. But we should remember, and this is a kind of a little known fact, actually, that the first three actors who played Charlie Chang in the silent film era were not white. They were Asian, two Japanese and one Korean. But somehow they didn't have enough star power to make the character a success. And especially the last one, E.L. Park, you know, that movie, Behind the Curtain. In that movie, you know, if you forgive my, you know, my pun, that Charlie Chang literally fell off the picture. Because in this one-hour film, Charlie Chang appears for no more than a minute. So, but anyway, it wasn't until, you know, Warner Olin, this great Swedish actor who had made a name for himself in this 1927 Al Jolson's Jazz Singer, in which, you know, Olin played this Jewish cantor, right, the father, who had only one, you know, worse, you know, speech in the whole movie, which is stop, which is stop or something like that. And that, and after that, the whole movie, you know, because remember, that was the first so-called talkie made in Hollywood. And the minute, you know, the cantor said, stop, and the movie went back to the silent mode, really. And so it was an interesting moment. But anyway, so Warner Olin made a name for himself for playing a Jew. And he also played, you know, Chinese villain, Dr. Fu Manchu, before he was picked to play this good Chinese Charlie Chan. And between 1931 and 1937, before, you know, Olin drank himself to death, he made about, 16 Charlie Chan novels, followed by Sidney Toler, and then followed by Roland Winter. Altogether, there were, you know, 47 films out there, Charlie Chan films out there. Everyone has a favorite. My favorite still is, you know, good old Warner Olin, who was very serious about playing Charlie Chan, or what I call this yellow face performance. You know, he studied Chinese literature, read up on Chinese, you know, he studied Chinese language and read up on Chinese literature, philosophy and art and everything. And when he was so good at this performance, so when he went to Shanghai, you know, went to visit Shanghai and Beijing in 1936, he was literally kind of mobbed by journalists and fans, you know, and people called him Charlie Chan. And at a news conference, you know, upon his arrival in Shanghai, he was actually able to deliver a few, you know, lines in Chinese, sing some Chinese. And although, you know, he's still kind of doing this Charlie Chan, you know, kind of performance, he would say, so honored to be back in my honorable homeland, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, and the cottage industry of Chinese cinema at the time even began to, you know, to crank out its own homegrown Charlie Chan films. And unfortunately, these, you know, the reels of these Chinese knockoffs, you know, have been lost. But according to contemporary accounts, you know, the Chinese actor who played Charlie Chan, these Chinese knockoffs, you know, imitated Olin's you know, incarnation almost, you know, in all aspects, you know, jazz, talk, walk. So we are really talking about this somewhat bizarre kind of frontier of yellow face in many ways, that you would see a real Chinaman imitating a Swede's imitation of a Chinaman. But such acts of racial ventriloquism in which, you know, a white actor will play an Asian or a Native American or a black, you know, character, you know, these are racial ventriloquism. Especially this kind of yellow face became a thorny issue in the reception of Charlie Chan, as we all know. And especially, after the civil rights movement and the Asian American protests in the 60s and 70s, and Charlie Chan has really been somewhat taboo, you know, for many Asian Americans, for very good reason. And we have to understand, you know, that's the period when, you know, American children were still, you know, sing, you know, this kind of jump rope song on the street, like Sing Song Chinaman Sitting on the Fence, et cetera, right? Or your neighborhood kids will come to you, if you're Asian growing up at the time, your neighborhood kids will come to you and do Charlie Chan imitations on you or do a Confucius say to you. So those, you know, memories are really painful and impossible to erase. But we also have to understand that's also a period, I think, that Charlie Chan's image was really tarnished. And I want to explain why. In that kind of, you know, it was right after World War II. We have to remember the last Charlie Chan movie, I think it was called The Sky Dragon, when it was being shown around the country in the summer of 1949, that was also the moment when Americans, you know, were mourning the loss of China, because that was the end of Chinese Civil War, right? The nationalists and communists, the communists won, defeated the nationalists who were supported by the United States, unwisely maybe, I don't know, I'm sorry. But anyway, when Mao was announced on October 1st, 1949, at Tiananmen Square, you know, this the founding of the People's Republic of China. That was the moment, you know, as if, you know, the whole continent of Asia was being swallowed up and by a Red Sea, for that matter. So in that, after that, you know, in that kind of Cold War kind of propaganda and anti-communist paranoia, for Charlie Chung to continue to, you know, wisecrack in that kind of poison air, because that's when all things Chinese will take on kind of negative and insidious connotations, right? We only have to, I mean, many of you will remember, for instance, you know, you pick any film noir movie, that you always find that a character with Charlie Chung mustache and dubious kind of Chinese name, you know, hovering in the background, kind of dark, eerie background. Or another example, a very famous one, you know, Roman Polanski's, you know, Chinatown with Jack Nicholson. You know, the punchline at the end of the movie was what? Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. Meaning, you know, anything with C words, you know, will be insidious and negative. So there is a reason, I think, you know, Charlie Chung in that period became a very problematic, you know, character. You know, on the one hand, there's a Cold War mentality. On the other hand, there's the racism against Asian Americans, for that matter. So there is a very good reason, as I point out in the book, that, for instance, you know, a famous writer, Asian American writer, Jessica Hagedorn, will announce, you know, in 1993 that Charlie Chung is dead, right? So there's a very good reason for that. But somehow, you know, Charlie, like a cat with nine lives, you know, has lived on. And I don't really think we can, you know, explain his longevity in American culture by simply referring to the persistence of racism. You know, I just don't buy that argument. To me, his essential charm was really his being a sage, a wise man, a hilarious, wisecracking sage. And, you know, he reminds me really of this Chinese monkey king, Sun Wukong, you know, who hides his weapon inside his ear. And Charlie Chung, you know, hides his, you know, aphoristic weapon inside his very sizable tummy, really. And so his so-called inscrutability, and that's the most, you know, negative stereotype against Asians, is the so-called inscrutability, right? But Charlie Chung, his inscrutability to me is really Asian humor in disguise, you know. So, for instance, I mean, his sayings may not be as nasty as some of the other kinds of things, for instance, like, your mama is so fat, when she steps on the scale, it says, to be continued. Or your mama is so stupid, she sold her car for gas money. You know, his sayings are never so nasty, but sometimes, you know, his aphorism can be very insulting. Give you an example, for instance, in The Black Camel, 1929, movie made in 1931. Charlie Chung was handling a case, a murder case, in which there was a white British suspect who was complaining bitterly of being handled by a Chinaman. So he was saying, like, why can't they send a white man out here? Why am I being handled by a Chinaman? And, of course, Charlie Chung was offended, and he said, the man who's about to cross the stream should not revile the crocodile's mother. And the guy said, what do you mean by that? So he can be very insulting, for that matter. So speaking of aphorisms, since, you know, every meal at a Chinese restaurant in America, you know, ends inevitably with fortune cookie, I'm going to read some Chinisms as kind of, as a sort of a conclusion to my rambling, if you could bear with me. But I should frame it by saying, you know, these are really, at the end of the book, I included about 50 Charlie Chungisms. These are really $20 a laugh. Because in order to get the permission, you know, to print this, reprint this, I have to pay about $1,000 for the bag of 50. But I'm offering them to you free. You know. So here we go. Action. Speak louder than French. At night, all cats are black. Biggest mistakes in history made by people who didn't think. Big head is only a good place for very large headache. Caution, very good life insurance. Even wise flies sometimes mistake spider web for old man's whiskers. And this is my next one, is my favorite. Every maybe has a wife called maybe not. Favorite pastime of man is fooling himself. A fool and his money never become old acquaintances. The fool questions others, the wise man questions himself. Front seldom tell truth. To know occupants of house, always look in backyard. Guessing is cheap, but wrong guess expensive, which is quite true. If befriend donkey, expect to be kicked. That's a great thing to have on your Facebook, you know, making friends. If no one had praised the donkey song, he will not still be singing. Man who flirt with dynamite sometimes fly with angels. Mind, like parachute, only function when open. Murder, like potato chip, cannot stop at just one. Optimist only sees donut. Pessimist sees hole. People who listen at keyholes rarely hear good of themselves. Perfect case, like perfect donut, has hole. Police do not read Emily Post. They should have the bumper sticker at the back of the police car for that matter, really. The secret is to talk much but say nothing. Smart fly keep out of gravy. Some heads, like hot nuts, much better if well cracked. I usually put it on my syllabus, you know, for my students. Talk cannot cook rice. Time only wasted when sprinkling perfume on goat farm. To know forgery, one must have original. Tongue often hand man quicker than rope. Trouble, like first love, teach many lessons. It's kind of sweet. Very few after-dinner speeches are equipped with self-stoppers. That's why we have fortune cookies, so no one have to give a speech. You know, we just read our cookies instead. It's a nice way to end our dinner. And this next one is really true. When money talk, few are deaf. When searching for needle in haystack, haystack only sensible location. So in a way, I've been searching for this kind of needle, Charlie Chung needle in a haystack, you know, and I hope I'm at a sensible location for that matter. So thank you very much.
Hi, Professor Wong. I have a two-part question about Earl Durr Biggers. First, about the difficulties that you encountered attempting to verify whether Mr. Biggers had actually discovered something in the New York Public Library reading room from a Honolulu newspaper. And second, could you describe the circumstances under which Mr. Biggers and Changapana finally met in Honolulu?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, the first one, I have to disappoint you, remains a mystery, you know. Biggers made many claims, and especially this one, as you, Dennis says, that he claimed to, you know, have a come across, you know, the newspaper article, a small item, in an obscure corner about this detective, Changapana and Lee Fook. But the thing is, when you contact Honolulu Police Department, there's a letter written by a then, you know, assistant kind of, director or something, you know, they checked the record. There was no Lee Fook for that matter. So it's impossible that, Biggers would have come across that newspaper item. As I will put in the book, it's like that claim is probably as fishy as the fifth ace on the river. You know what it means. As for the second question, can you remind me again? I'm sorry. Yes.
The question was the circumstances under which Mr. Biggers finally met Changapana
right, okay,
in Honolulu.
Well, yes, right. Thank you. He wrote a number of Charlie Chan novels before he eventually met up with Chanapana, which is a great, to me, is a great historical meeting. You know, he immediately, you know, sent out an invitation to meet Chanapana on the second day of his arrival in Honolulu. That was in July of 1928. And the meeting took place in this great, you know, historical place, the Royal Hawaii Hotel, which is still there, this Pink Palace of Pacific, that's the nickname for it. So they met up there, and they took pictures together. Unfortunately, the picture that was released to the press later on was not a picture of, you know, Biggers with Chanapana. It was actually Biggers with a standing Charlie Chan, who I suspect was actually a bellhop from the hotel, who's Chinese, and who looked a lot more like Charlie Chan, I guess, because by that time, you know, Chanapana was a kind of old, you know, wrinkled man who has no resemblance, basically, to this kind of fat, you know, character in the novel. So we have a stand-in instead, and I have both pictures, you know, in the book, and you can compare why is there, you know, this kind of which is more real, and you know, as like they say in one of the, you know, if you remember the Hanna-Barbera kind of, you know, later on the 70s kind of recreation of Charlie Chan, the Amazing Chan, the Chang Clan, you know, you have like, will the real Charlie Chan please stand up? You know, that's my question I'm asked all the time. Will the real Charlie Chan please stand up? Which one is real? Thank you, Danny.
Ed Plow, the former chairman of the literature department at San Diego State University.
Hi, thanks for the presentation.
Okay.
Like Dennis, I have a couple of questions. The first about Charlie, and the second about you as a writer. The one about Charlie is that Fenollosa, Lafarge, Hearn even, they appealed to intellectuals. And so they were interested in Asia, but if were they alive, my guess is they'd have no interest in Charlie.
This question is a little long, and the answer is a little protracted also, so I think we'll cut it off there. And interesting book. Like I said, you can approach this book at several levels, just sort of tracing the history of what Charlie Chan is like and how he got to what he turned out to be. On the other hand, it goes into a lot of the ideas of the perception of the author about the acceptance of Asians in American society, racism, etc. So, interesting book. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the night. Look on the show bill and you see what we're going to do next week. And thank you for joining us. And we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off again with We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.